Going fishing. Australia's nuclear technology podcast. Welcome back, listeners. This episode, I speak to Ron Camier, retired chemical engineer who used to work in research and development in Victoria's power industry during the SEC days. A slight deviation in subject matter, because this will be largely concerning the use of brown coal. Just before I continue on, you may notice there are some cuts in and out when I ask questions of Ron. Nothing untoward here, it's simply during recording, I had another interviewer assisting me with this episode. I've simply paraphrased and cut my own question back in, just for consistency's sake. Please enjoy this episode of Going Fishing. Ron Camier, welcome to Going Fishing.
Thank you.
Thanks for agreeing to come and speak with us. Could you tell us a little bit about who you are and your career history?
Yeah, well, I'm a long-term Latrobe Valley resident, a retired chemical engineer who's worked in energy research and development, particularly relating to brown coal technologies. And I've worked at the University of Melbourne Brown Coal Research Laboratory, the SEC Herman Research Laboratory, the Victorian Brown Coal Council Development Division, Brown Coal Liquefaction Victoria, which was a joint Japanese-Australian project, the Coal Corporation of Victoria, and HRL Limited.
So it sounds to me this is all R&D around coal and basically developing the capabilities and what we could get out of this particular resource.
Yeah, that's right. Victoria, Latrobe Valley, has the world's largest economically winnable brown coal deposit. When I was at university, they used to say that 96% of Victoria's energy is in the form of brown coal. We've got 4% Bass Strait oil and gas, and we should conserve those things for premium purposes and find clever ways to use coal for everything else.
Is brown coal? How does it differentiate from, say, bituminous or black coal?
Yeah, brown coal is a younger coal than black coal, and it's more reactive, but it also has a very high moisture content. Now, Victorian coal used to be known as the cleanest in the world because of its very low sulfur, nitrogen, and ash contents, but the way brown coal has been burned in conventional power stations means that because of the high moisture content, to evaporate that moisture, we need to burn more coal, about 25% more coal, which in turn creates about 25% more carbon dioxide. So now people say carbon dioxide is a pollutant, therefore brown coal is the dirtiest coal in the world.
What sort of developments were you able to achieve in utilising this resource?
Probably the one that's the most relevant to, I think, what you're talking about is a locally developed technology for brown coal power generation called integrated drying, gasification and combined cycle. And to quickly explain that, what it does is it's a process under high pressure that converts coal to a gas which can be burned in a gas turbine, and then the remaining heat from that process goes to a conventional steam boiler and steam turbine. So you've got a steam cycle as well as a gas turbine cycle. And what's particularly clever about this process is that the water in the coal, which is regarded as a disadvantage, as a waste in conventional power generation, in IDGCC, it's actually used to advantage, because that water, under pressure, goes through the gas turbine and is part of the working fluid that generates more power. So we get 30% more electricity from the same amount of coal as a conventional power station, and therefore 30% less carbon dioxide.
That sounds similar to what was done in developing combined cycle gas turbines. Is that analogous, or are they more separate?
Well, the similarity is, yes, a combined cycle is gas turbine plus steam turbine. What was extra with our technology, which was developed by HRL, is that it was specifically for very wet brown coal, and so it integrated a drying process at the front end of that plant. So yeah. it was a very, very efficient technology.
Is that technology still in utilisation at the moment in Morwell?
What happened was in Morwell we had a 10 megawatt pilot plant which operated, and at the end of that HRL decided that they wanted to build a 600 megawatt demonstration plant on their site, the Energy Bricks site in Morwell, and at that time the political situation was such that there was a green balance of power, and so they said no, you can't, and after a few iterations of that, basically HRL subsequently went bankrupt, and that was and everyone who worked there, that was the end of their career.
What year was this?
Well, this was from the late 1990s, early 2000s was when all of that was happening.
Okay, now HRL is Hermann Research Labs, yeah?
That's the origin of those letters, but HRL Limited was just HRL.
Okay.
The Hermann Research Laboratory was part of the SEC. So HRL was a private...
Okay.
Company,
yep.
Formed from the research and development part of the SEC,
yep.
The Hermann Research Laboratory, combined with the Coal Corporation of Victoria, which is part of the organisation that I came from.
Okay, so when all those SEC assets were privatised, that became HRL became a private entity?
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Okay, and it was obviously trying to do some science and do some R&D, and ultimately it was politics that brought it undone?
It was, yeah, the timing of when it was proposed to be developed was unfortunate, and HRL going broke wasn't directly as a result of that, it was another factor, but mm-hmm. Yeah, it was unfortunate because it was the best technology in the world, and combined with the coal that we have in Victoria, which is the best quality brown coal in the world, it would have... been a real opportunity.
So this is actually a technology that has never been able to be commercialised because of political reasons.
Correct.
And this is not the technology that we're taking advantage of with what is currently existing in Morwell in Latrobe Valley.
The technology in Latrobe Valley is old technology. Yeah. But in Germany, they're using somewhat similar technologies to the IDGCC, but not quite as good.
How much cleaner would utilising this technology have been?
Well, 30% is the figure we use.
Significant, yeah. Well, it does irritate me because having read through Keith Alder's book and how much political meddling, intervention there has been in technological developments, and so much capability was basically, and skilled people and careers were basically squandered. Basically from the whims of politics, and it looks like this is just another chapter in that same story.
Yep.
How do you feel about that? What did that mean to you and your career?
Oh, well, it certainly is very disappointing. Mm. Not just for myself, though. I think the electricity industry generally is suffering from a lot of misinformation, not just to do with brown coal, but also to do with renewables, and I think also to do with nuclear. You know, all of those things need to be understood better, and I feel that technical people like myself have not done a good enough job in explaining things to the general public. That's why there's so much misinformation out there.
It seems to be a big, like one of the buzzwords, science communicator. You know, science communicators, we need more science communicators. Is that what you think we need? Is there a way to do that, or is that something that should be developed?
I think the answer is yes, but I'd just draw a slight distinction, and that's between science and engineering. Science is what is technically possible. Engineering is not just what's scientifically possible, but also what's economically viable, and that brings those two things together.
It's like the old saying, any idiot can build a bridge that stands, but only an engineer can build a bridge that barely stands.
Yeah, that's another way of putting it.
We've got coal in Victoria, we've got hard coal in New South Wales and Queensland. You've got a lot of renewables happening in South Australia, intermittent renewables in South Australia. We've got a lot of hydro in Snowy Hydro and in Tasmania. So how do these technologies interrelate, and how do you feel that preferencing one over the other technically?
Yeah, well, all of those things need to be brought together, which is what a national grid is all about. But the important thing, I think, is to understand the importance of baseload electricity generation, because what we're trying to do is match supply and demand. And baseload power generation, which is coal-fired power, nuclear power, they're technologies that are very capital intensive, relatively low operating cost but high capital cost. Therefore, those sort of technologies need to be run continuously as close as possible to 100% capacity. And then to match to demand, where there's variation, so you get the morning peak and the evening peak, that's where you use things like hydro and gas turbine, which is quick, they're things that are quick to turn on and off. And unfortunately, renewables don't fit anywhere in that system because they just randomly fluctuate during the day. Generally, they give their peaks in the middle of the day when it's not needed, and that impacts negatively on baseload power generation. And that is fundamentally the problem that is causing the demise of the baseload power industry, so coal at this stage, but will also, I believe, be a real problem for nuclear in the future.
Can you speak to what the implications could be for our grid if we force in high penetrations, like 80% or more, of intermittent renewable generation?
Yeah, well, to have high renewables because of the fluctuation that's inherent and because of the cost. One of the factors that's not well understood is something known as the second law of thermodynamics, which is to do with the whether energy is high grade or low grade. And with renewables, you are basically using low grade energy, so sunlight, wind, and having to concentrate them. And that is inherently expensive, no matter how cheaply you can make the components. So what a high renewables situation would bring is very high electricity costs, and we're seeing that happening already, plus unreliable unless we have a huge amount of storage, so things like batteries, pumped hydro, things like that, which is just going to add further to the cost and basically make Australia as a nation uncompetitive on the world scale. So all our manufacturing, which relies on electricity at a reasonable cost, will have to close down, and everything will be imported as a result.
You mentioned about entropy and high grade and low grade sources of fuel and energy storage. Mm-hmm. I think it's no surprise to anyone, especially anyone listening to this, that obviously uranium is the highest energy density fuel. Fossil fuels are solid, they're nowhere near uranium, but then yes, you step down to wind and solar are such very energy dilute systems. Where do batteries sit in that hierarchy, do you reckon?
Well, batteries are really just something that it become necessary because of the erratic nature of renewables. And the real problem with batteries is they are manufactured from, to a large degree, rare earth minerals, and the amount of mining that is likely to be necessary to produce the quantities of batteries. I think I've seen a figure that if If all fossil fuel energy in the world was converted to renewables, and we just needed a 4-week supply, of like a battery backup to cover 4 weeks, then the quantity of lithium, if we're talking lithium ion batteries, would be almost, at current production rates, nearly 10,000 years mining would be required to produce the amount of lithium that's needed. And you can do similar calculations for a lot of other of these minerals that are needed for making batteries. And really, it's just, it's beyond imagination how we could construct enough batteries to achieve what is necessary.
Is that a 4-week window to service the world electricity need?
And well, anywhere, whatever scale grid you're talking about, that's the sort of battery backup that is thought to be necessary. And we're not going to be able to manufacture, and because it's not bulk mineral mining like iron ore or coal that we're used to. These are rare minerals, and you need to move a lot of earth to get a very small amount of mineral, and building these batteries is just going to be a huge challenge, and I don't see it as being viable.
At the risk of following a tangent, the deindustrialisation over the last couple of decades in Australia, has that encouraged us to pursue this development in harnessing low-grade energy? And would this have been possible had we maintained our industrial capability?
Well, that's a good question. That you look at where, for example, solar panels coming from, where wind turbines coming from. That sort of manufacturing is increasingly coming from overseas, and as our energy costs, our electricity costs increase in Australia, all of our manufacturing, including what's needed for renewables, will have to come from overseas, and our ability to pay for that is going to become more and more limited.
Do you think there is a requirement or an incentive for any nation to be able to provide its own manufacturing capability?
Well, obviously it's a desirable thing. For employment as well as for national security. And I think the path that we are on at the moment in Australia is pretty hazardous because of that.
You mentioned storage in terms of battery for 4 weeks. Why do we choose 4 weeks as the number? Do we just not need it for overnight for when the sun goes down? Why do we need 4 weeks?
It's the variation is seasonal as well as daily.
Okay, so is it fair to assume that 4 weeks is just a number? It could be longer?
It could be more, it could be less.
It's just a ballpark figure that you do the back of the calculation.
Calculations, there's a Associate Professor Simon Michel from Finland has recently done a lot of detailed work on this. I don't know whether you're aware of that, but he's crunched all the numbers on this.
Okay, I'll see if I can find
it. Useful information.
See if I can add it to the show notes at the end of it. Mm. Well, if batteries are not going to do it, what options do we have in other storage mediums, such as pumped hydro?
Well, pumped hydro is like a subdivision of hydro generally. And if you're talking about Australia, you need very high rainfall and lots of mountains to have hydro. And we have very limited resources in that regard.
What are the implications for a technology such as hydro and by extension pumped hydro on a nation that is essentially flat and arid?
Well, Australia is a country that is limited in our resources for hydro, but we should use what resources we have there to the maximum extent we can. And really, if there's to be a solution to this, it needs this whole electricity situation. It needs to be a blend of everything. We need to have balance. So we need hydro, we need nuclear, we need renewables, and we need everything else that we can put into the picture with grids that to have interconnections. So all of that will be needed, and we will still struggle to achieve it. And at the moment, the problem is there's a lot of polarisation going on. It's all or nothing. There are groups saying it must all be renewable, and it can't be. There are groups saying it should be fossil fuels, and it can't be. There are groups saying it should be nuclear, and it can't be. We need to get the right balance.
Where do you think something has to give, something has to break? Technically, what would you place your money on? What do you think is going to break first?
Look, I don't know. I'm pretty disappointed with what's happening at the moment in Australia. I think the collapse of coal-fired power generation without anything to replace it is heading us for trouble. I don't know what the solution is unless there's a major change in the way we're heading.
Do you have children or grandchildren, and are you concerned on their behalf for what an oncoming crisis could mean for their future prosperity?
Sure, I feel very disappointed, and as I say, I feel to some degree responsible for not having done my bit to communicate the hazards of what's happening at the moment with our electricity industry and the impact that will have on manufacturing, employment and lifestyle. I think all of that, unless we change, is going to suffer.
You mentioned communication. What do you think you could have done? It sounds like you've got some regret there. What do you think you would have done differently had you had your time again?
That's hard to really to answer. It's a hypothetical. So, but it's clear that the general public do not understand the nature of the electricity industry, and a lot of the decision makers are ill-advised. And you know, I don't blame politicians actually, because politicians are just chasing the popular vote, and it's the people who are misinformed, and those of us who have some technical understanding should have done a better job of making this information known to the general public. And often, I suppose, these things are done within government organisations or corporate bodies, and confidentiality is always a big issue there, and that constrains engineers and scientists speaking out to some degree.
A previous guest mentioned that when I asked him about the SEC and the potential revitalization of that organization, I wonder if that is going to become the vessel by which responsibility for delivering and making electricity reliable, the buck is going to fall back to the SEC. I think Stephen Wilson's summed it up multiple times when he says, "Are we sleepwalking back into central planning?" Mm-hmm. What do you reckon about that? Do you think that could be the outcome here?
Well, certainly the way the electricity industry is collapsing means that private industry is walking away from it, and the governments will need to step in. So that's what's behind this move for SEC being revived. But I need to say that, as Ray said, that the SEC that's being talked about now is nothing like what used to exist. And what I might just mention, the way the SEC operated previously in Victoria was understanding the nature of brown coal fired baseload electricity, running it to a very high level of, you know, close to 100%, and then using the small amount of hydro and gas-fired peaking plant to meet the peaks, virtually giving away off-peak electricity at night. So there were things like heat banks and off-peak water heaters that were very, very cheap, and industry that ran 24/7 got very cheap power, and that really underpinned Victoria's prosperity for nearly 80 years. And that's what the SEC used to do, and that is very different from what's being proposed at the moment.
As someone whose technical career ran alongside the era of the SEC and central planning, do you have a nostalgia for the way it was done back then? What do you think of the market-based approach that we've embraced over the last few decades? And do you think it would be a good idea to go back to a central planning model?
Yeah, the SEC was an organisation that was technically very competent, but the disadvantage with centralised planning was that it was very vulnerable as well. And this is where the union movement got a bit out of control during the 80s and 90s, and there needed to be reform of the SEC. It was a target that it was too big, it was vulnerable, and during the Kennedy era, that was a means to try and correct that problem, but it in a sense went too far. It followed what had happened with the Thatcher era in the UK, which had already been proven to fail before the changes were brought into place in Victoria, which was unfortunate, but once that trend had started, it couldn't be stopped.
Can you weigh up the pros and cons of each of these approaches, being the centralised planning versus the market planning, and where we had wins and where we had losses?
Yeah. It's difficult to just give you a straight answer on that, because there were certainly positives to centralised planning. Certainly in the early days of the SEC, you know, from Sir John Monash onwards through the 50s, 60s, 70s, all that growth that took place, economic growth as a result of developing cheap power generation in Victoria. But then as the SEC got bigger and became more vulnerable, then the union pressures came to bear, and it started to fail. So privatisation was the consequence of that, and there have been problems with privatisation as well. So, you know, there's no perfect system. There are elements of both that we need and elements of both that we don't need.
What do you mean by vulnerability? Was it that it was too large or too many people?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was big, and because it was this great monolith, then it could be held to ransom, and that's what happened.
Do you think central planning will be necessary for nuclear power to gain a foothold in the Australian market?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think nuclear power, it's the introduction has so many hurdles that it would have to clear, that it's probably only as a result of centralised electricity system planning that it could come about. There are some significant problems, even though, as you know, Australia has great resources of uranium and so on. There are some fundamental problems with waste disposal. You know, in theory, it can be done, but where do you do it? And power generation itself, it can be done, and especially the smaller modular reactors are perhaps easier to introduce, but even so, you need to convince people that they need to be able to live to some degree in proximity to this sort of thing. So if you ask, go out and ask a person in the street, are you prepared to live within 1 kilometre of a nuclear power plant, or 10 kilometres or whatever it might be, and then apply that to every citizen of Australia, where are you going to put the nuclear power plants? It's an issue. And likewise with the waste disposal, it has to be storage. There's no way of processing it. And it's, I guess, a sobering thought to consider that the half-lives of a lot of these nuclear waste is more than any civilization has existed on Earth. So the storage has to be very, very secure. And then, of course, there's also the question of possible misuse of nuclear materials. And you could almost say that, well, perhaps we need world peace before we can be assured of nuclear materials not being misused. And I don't see any signs of world peace happening at the present time. So those are the challenges that the nuclear industry have to face. In addition to that, I would add the same problem that has affected brown coal power generation, in that it is it's damaged by the fluctuation caused by renewables. Nuclear power is still essentially a capital intensive technology, and it will still be subject to the same sort of damaging influences from renewables, and that might be a showstopper for nuclear as well.
So when you talk about these damaging influences, you're talking technically like the intermittency and the need to match the supply with the demand,
yeah,
which is not...
So because there's a lot of what they call before the meter renewable electricity, the demand curve goes up and down dramatically, and so a nuclear power plant, just like at the moment what the coal-fired power plants are having to do, would have to try and follow that. And so that means turning stations on and off, spooling them up and down. And what that does is, firstly, it means that they are not running at close to 100% capacity, so that impacts on their commercial viability. And secondly, physically, you've got these massive steel structures that are heating and cooling, and so the thermal stresses on the reactors and on the power plants themselves, that is going to damage them physically. That's what's causing the brown coal power stations to close at the moment. It's the cracking that occurs from thermal stresses, and if nuclear power has to do the same thing, they will suffer from the same problem.
Is Australia an innovative nation?
Definitely. Yeah, Australia is an innovative country, but any sort of innovation needs to be communicated well to the general public. And maybe that's where we have a problem at the moment.
Now, I'm going to come back to the thermal stresses from ramping up and down. Are you familiar with some of the novel designs, such as the SMRs, like the BWX-300, mm-hmm. and the NuScale reactors? Now, a lot of those guys, the people developing those, are saying, no, we've decided that, and we reckon we can develop a system that can actually load follow quite comfortably. Mm. Have you followed up with that, or...?
Yeah, look, I understand that. What they're doing is, by making smaller modules, they can turn them on and off easier. So, yes, it's an improvement, I agree, but there's still fundamentally the same issue they're fighting against.
In your opinion, if you had total power to build an Australian electricity grid, how would you do it? What resources, what technologies would you use?
Well, it would need to be a balance. We need to use all resources. We need to use as much renewable as we can fit into the system without causing economic and fluctuation in the demand curve. So that needs to be balanced with baseload power, and that baseload power needs to include high efficiency, low emission coal as well as nuclear. And then there'll still be gaps in the middle, which we'll need, well, we'll use hydro as much as we can, but also we need to use natural gas. But natural gas is increasingly a scarce and valuable resource, and we should be trying to keep that to a minimum.
If, and when you say renewables, I'm going to assume you mean intermittent renewables like solar and wind. If they are a parasite on the load, do we actually need them in this hypothetical system? Or could we make a system that is more reliable, cheaper to run, just without them?
If you're just talking about reliability and economics, yes, we'd be better without them. But the big question that the world's facing at the moment is carbon dioxide emissions, climate change. So we need renewables in the mix because of that.
But we know that nuclear can at least do very much the heavy lifting of baseload, and the idea of SMRs can do these ramping up and down. If they can do that without the, if they can do that low carbon, mm-hmm. And they can still do it economically, why would we need intermittent renewables?
Well, I'm just saying we need a blend of all of those things. And I've mentioned already what the disadvantages are with nuclear, even the SMRs. Mm. Those issues are still valid, so we need a balance.
Okay.
We don't want polarisation with pressure groups saying it must be all something and nothing something else. We need to bring all of it together, and that's a communication problem, and that's where really I think we're falling down more than anything else.
I seem to the argument I see is that a lot of the pitfalls or the things holding nuclear back seem to be image or acceptance issues, though the issues we have with, I'm going to say, intermittent renewables are technical issues. And if I had to put money on one or the other, I know which ones are easier to overcome, or at least from an engineer's point of view.
I think both of those technologies suffer the same fundamental problem, which is communication of technical realities to the general public.
For better or for worse, natural gas appears to be the solution for filling in the gaps left by intermittent renewables. What are your thoughts on this, and where do you think this path is going to lead us?
Yeah, look, what's happening is there is a growing gap between the declining base load and the growing erratic renewable input. And that gap, by default, really, is being filled by gas at the moment. And we can't keep doing that. Gas is a finite resource, and it's still a fossil fuel. So there is no real long-term future for gas other than for relatively minor peaking capacity.
Cool. What do you think about not just hydrogen, but synfuels, synthetic fuels more generally? Do you have an opinion on these?
Okay, you're probably not aware that the project that brought me from Melbourne down to Latrobe Valley originally was a joint Japanese-Australian coal-to-oil plant to produce synthetic fuels for transport.
Oh, very good. Tell us more.
Which the technology we used was called direct hydrogenation, where we manufactured hydrogen and basically reacted that hydrogen with a slurry of coal in oil. And these big high-pressure reactors, the coal molecules are broken down, the hydrogen is added, and we produce liquid fuels from that. So that's a synthetic fuel, but it's still using coal.
So it sounds like, because I've heard the term that, you know, hydrogen is the popular one, the buzz one that everyone likes to talk about. Not sure that a lot of technical people have quite agreed that this is the way to go. But the concept of being able to develop synthetic crude is something that I think is interesting and possibly another avenue that shouldn't be discarded. Sounds like what you were describing there was a way of developing synthetic crude. Is that
apt? Yeah, well, that was one way. There were others. This is back the late 70s, early 80s, when all that was happening. I think what you're talking about now, though, is hydrogen as a fuel.
Well, synthetic fuels more broadly, I personally think that hydrogen is one particular option. I think it hogs too much of the limelight. Yeah. I think there are other options there that should also be considered. Just considering the difficulty of managing something like hydrogen.
Yeah, look, I agree with you. I mean, let me first say there are two main routes to producing hydrogen. One is through coal gasification, primarily, and there's a lot of chemical processing required for that. And if you're using coal as your source material, you are still inevitably going to produce carbon dioxide as a byproduct. So if carbon dioxide is a major pollutant and a problem, then that's the issue with producing hydrogen from coal. The other way to produce hydrogen is from electrolysis of water, splitting the hydrogen and the oxygen. And that requires vast amounts of electricity. And then you then have to ask the question, well, where is all that electricity going to come from? And if we're not going to use...
low carbon.
Yeah, carbon coal for that, then are we going to use renewables? And the cost of that, we've already talked about the cost of renewables, so that hydrogen becomes excessively expensive as well. So whichever way you produce hydrogen, it's difficult and it's expensive. It's probably the only way that you can power heavy transport, like trains and trucks, that sort of thing, if you're going to a carbon-free world. Because simply batteries, the weight of batteries, whatever sort of batteries you use, is going to be prohibitive. Electric vehicles really only works for small passenger transport. So, that then raises the question about if we're going to have a hydrogen economy, and I know the Japanese are working on that. We've got a test plant that was running in Luoyang, in the Latrobe Valley until recently. But the thing about hydrogen also is that I have concerns about handling it. It is a very difficult and dangerous material. At the coal to oil plant that I was talking about, there was an accident that occurred because of hydrogen. Because it's such a small molecule, it can escape very easily, and it's explosive. It's a very dangerous, we know LPG, we can handle that, but it's still very dangerous. Hydrogen magnifies the safety concerns of LPG. So yeah, I'm very wary about large-scale use of hydrogen from a safety point of view.
You mentioned the ways to develop hydrogen gas. You mentioned coal reformation, you mentioned electrolysis. My understanding, I thought, was that the majority of hydrogen produced today is from steam reformation process and natural gas. Is that the case?
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay, it depends how far back you want to go.
Okay.
Hydrogen production is a gas processing, so you can start from natural gas, but natural gas is, as I said, an expensive, relatively expensive and relatively limited resource.
Okay.
That we can use natural gas as an energy source in its own right very efficiently. To turn it into hydrogen is inefficient and will be making that hydrogen far more expensive. So therefore, if you're producing hydrogen from fossil fuels, if that's an acceptable solution, then coal gasification is the way to do it.
Now this leads into my next question, because I've heard of this term of coal gasification before, but my understanding, coal is just layers of carbon. There's no hydrogen in there to turn into hydrogen gas. Where does this hydrogen come from in coal gasification?
Okay, well, sorry, there is hydrogen in coal. But also, in the reaction of gasification, you introduce water, which has hydrogen in it as well. So by what's called steam reforming, you produce, and there's what's called a shift reaction, you can manipulate so that you produce hydrogen, and then you have to separate it, which is also very expensive form of processing, because basically you've got to remove everything else from the hydrogen, and the hydrogen you get is a very small percentage of what originally was in the coal or the natural gas or whatever your source is. You still it's a very expensive processing route.
We'll wrap this interview up fairly shortly, but before we do, fusion. Is this a pipe dream?
I wouldn't call it a pipe dream. I think it's something that is essential, but it is going to be very challenging to introduce. But it needs to be done as part of a mix to solve the problem that we currently have with electricity.
As a resident of the Latrobe Valley for something like 40 years, what sort of developments and changes have you seen in the community?
Yeah, I've seen some exciting things happen in Latrobe Valley. There's a lot of really good people live here, competent, capable people. But with the decline of the power industry and the coal industry, a lot of people have left, a lot of people have lost their jobs. And yeah, there has been a social impact, which has been fairly negative. So Latrobe Valley is a resilient place. So yeah, we have coped with this, but yeah, it has been very hard.
Thank you very much, Ron, for appearing on Going Fishing.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Once again, I'd like to thank Ron Cammier for allowing us some of his time to speak to us about the history of the SEC and his work. There are a couple of minor show notes specifically to Simon Michaud and some of his appearances on other podcasts, which I can recommend. Apart from that, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of Going Fishing. Until next time.